Chapter 7 Nocturne Hunger 1 Mia was in the castle again, but this time was different. This time she did not move slowly, toying with her hunger, knowing that soon it would be fed and fed completely, that both she and her chap would be satisfied. This time what she felt inside was ravenous desperation, as if some wild animal had been caged up inside her belly. She understood that what she had felt on all those previous expeditions hadn't been hunger at all, not true hunger, but only a healthy appetite. This was different. His time is coming, she thought. He needs to eat more in order to get his strength, and so do I. Yet she was afraid, she was terrified, that it wasn't just a matter of needing to eat more. There was something she needed to eat, something for special. The chap needed it in order to, well, to finish the becoming. Yes. Yes, that was it, the becoming. And surely she would find it in the banquet hall, because everything was in the banquet hall. 1,000 dishes, each more succulent than the last. She would graze the table, and when she found the right thing, the right vegetable or spice or meat or fish roe, her guts and nerves would cry out for it, and she would eat. Oh, she would gobble. She began to hurry along faster yet, and then to run. She was vaguely aware that her legs were swishing together because she was wearing pants, denim pants, like a cowboy. And instead of slippers, she was wearing boots. Shore boots, her mind whispered to her mind. Shore boots, may they do you fine. But none of this mattered. What mattered was eating, gorging, oh, she was so hungry, and finding the right thing for the chap. Finding the thing that would both make him strong and bring on her labor. She pelted down the broad staircase into the steady beating murmur of the slow trans engines. Wonderful smells should have overwhelmed her by now. Roasted meats, barbecued poultry, herbed fish. But she couldn't smell food at all. Maybe I have a cold, she thought as her shore boots stut-tut-tutted on the stairs. That must be it. I must have a cold. My sinuses are all swollen, and I can't smell anything. But she could. She could smell the dust and age of this place. She could smell damp seepage and the faint tang of engine oil and the mildew eating relentlessly into tapestries and curtains hung in the rooms of ruin. Those things. But no food. She dashed along the black marble floor toward the double doors, unaware that she was again being followed. Not by the gunslinger this time, but by a wide-eyed, tousle-haired boy in a cotton shirt and a pair of cotton shorts. Mia crossed the foyer with its red and black marble squares and the statue of smoothly entwined marble and steel. She didn't stop to curtsy or even nod her head. That she should be so hungry was bearable, but not her chap, never her chap. What halted her, and only for a space of seconds, was her own reflection, milky and irresolute, in the statue's chrome steel. Above her jeans was a plain white shirt, you call this kind a T-shirt, her mind whispered, with some writing on it and a picture. The picture appeared to be of a pig. Never mind what's on your shirt, woman. The chap's what matters. You must feed the chap. She burst into the dining hall and stopped with a gasp of dismay. The room was full of shadows now. A few of the electric torches still glowed, but most had gone out. As she looked, the only one still burning at the far end of the room stuttered, buzzed, and fell dark. The white for special plates had been replaced with blue ones decorated with green tendrils of rice. The rice plants formed the great letter Z sub N, which, she knew, meant eternity and now and also come, as in come Kamala. But plates didn't matter, decorations didn't matter. What mattered was that the plates and beautiful crystal glassware were empty and dull with dust. No, not everything was empty. In one goblet she saw a dead black widow spider lying with its many legs curled against the red hourglass on its midsection. She saw the neck of a wine bottle poking from a silver pail, and her stomach gave an imperative cry. She snatched it up, barely registering the fact that there was no water in the bucket, let alone ice. It was entirely dry, At least the bottle had weight and enough liquid inside to slosh, but before Mia could close her lips over the neck of the bottle, the smell of vinegar smote her so strongly that her eyes filled with water. "Motherfuck!" she screamed and threw the bottle down. "You motherfucker!" The bottle shattered on the stone floor. Things ran in, squeaking surprise beneath the table. "Yeah, you better run," she screamed. "Get your gun, whatever you are. Here's me, a daughter of none, and not in a good mood, yet I will be fed. Yes, yes, I will." This was bold talk, but at first she saw nothing on the table that she could eat. There was bread, but the one piece she bothered to pick up had turned to stone. There was what appeared to be the remains of a fish, but it had putrefied and lay in a greenish-white simmer of maggots. Her stomach growled, undeterred by this mess. Worse, something below her stomach turned restlessly and kicked and cried out to be fed. It did this not with its voice, but by turning certain switches inside her back in the most primitive sections of her nervous system. Her throat grew dry, her mouth puckered as if she had drunk the turned wine. Her vision sharpened as her eyes widened and bulged outward in their sockets, every thought, every sense, and every instinct tuned to the same simple idea, food. Beyond the far end of the table was a screen showing Arthur Eld, sword held high, riding through a swamp with three of his knight gunslingers behind him. Around his neck was Saïta, the great snake, which presumably he had just slain. Another successful quest. Do you find men in their quests? Bah, what was slaying a magical snake to her? She had a chap in her belly, and the chap was hungry. Hungry, she thought in a voice that wasn't her own. It's be hungry. Behind the screen were double doors. She shoved through them, still unaware of the boy Jake standing at the far end of the dining hall in his underwear, looking at her, afraid. The kitchen was likewise empty, likewise dusty. The counters were tattooed with critter tracks. Pots and pans and cooking racks were jumbled across the floor. Beyond this litter were four sinks, one filled with stagnant water that had grown a scum of algae. The room was lit by fluorescent tubes, only a few still glowed slightly. Most of them flickered on and off, giving these shambles a surreal and nightmarish aspect. She worked her way across the kitchen, kicking aside the pots and pans that were in her way. Here stood four huge ovens all around. The door of the third was ajar. From it came a faint shimmer of heat as one might feel coming from a hearth 6 or 8 hours after the last embers have burned out, and a smell that set her stomach clamoring all over again. It was the smell of freshly roasted meat. Mia opened the door. Inside was indeed some sort of roast. Feeding on it was a rat the size of a tomcat. It turned its head at the clunk of the opening oven door and looked at her with black, fearless eyes. Its whiskers, bleary with grease, twitched. Then it turned back to the roast. She could hear the muttering smack of its lips and the sound of tearing flesh. "Nay, Mr. Rat, it wasn't left for you. It was left for me and my chap." "One chance, my friend," she sang as she turned toward the counters and storage cabinets beneath them. "Better go while you can, fair warning." Not that it would, Mr. Rat, be hungry too. She opened a drawer and found nothing but breadboards and a rolling pin. She considered the rolling pin briefly, but had no wish to baste her dinner with more rat blood than she absolutely had to. She opened the cabinet beneath and found tins for muffins and molds for fancy desserts. She moved to her left, opened another drawer, and here was what she was looking for. Mia considered the knives. Took one of the meat forks instead. It had 2 6-inch steel tines. She took it back to the row of ovens, hesitated, and checked the other three. They were empty, as she had known they would be. Something, some fate, some providence, some ka, had left fresh meat, but only enough for one. Mr. Rat thought it was his. Mr. Rat had made a mistake. She did not think he would make another, not this side of the clearing anyway. She bent, and once again the smell of freshly cooked pork filled her nose. Her lips spread, and drool ran from the corners of her smile. This time Mr. Rat didn't look around. Mr. Rat had decided she was no threat. That was all right. She bent further forward, drew a breath, and impaled it on the meat fork. Rat kebab. She drew it out and held it up in front of her face. It squealed furiously, its legs spinning in the air, its head lashing back and forth, blood running down the meat fork's handle to pool around her fist. She carried it, still writhing, to the sink full of stagnant water and flipped it off the fork. It splashed into the murk and disappeared. For a moment, the tip of its twitching tail stuck up, and then that was gone too. She went down the line of sinks, trying the faucets, and from the last one got a feeble trickle of water. She rinsed her bloody hand under it until the trickle subsided. Then she walked back to the oven, wiping her hand dry on the seat of her breeches. She did not see Jake, now standing just inside the kitchen doors and watching her, although he made no attempt to hide. She was totally fixated on the smell of the meat. It wasn't enough, and not precisely what her chap needed, but it would do for the time being. She reached in, grasped the sides of the roasting pan, then pulled back with a gasp, shaking her fingers and grinning. It was a grin of pain, yet not entirely devoid of humor. Mr. Rat had either been a trifle more immune to the heat than she was, or maybe hungrier. Although it was hard to believe anyone or anything could be hungrier than she was right now. "I's hungry," she yelled, laughing as she went down the line of drawers, opening and closing them swiftly. "Me is one hungry lady, yes, sir. Didn't go to Moore House, didn't go to no house, but I's hungry, and my chap's hungry, too." In the last drawer, wasn't that always the way, she found the hot pads she'd been looking for. She hurried back to the oven with them in her hands, bent down and pulled the roast out. Her laughter died in a sudden, shocked gasp, and then burst out again, louder and stronger than ever. What a goose she was! What a damned silly billy! For one instant, she'd thought the roast, which had been done to a skin-crackling turn and only gnawed by Mr. Rat in one place, was the body of a child. And yes, she supposed that a roasted pig did look a little bit like a child, a baby, someone's chap. But now that it was out and she could see the closed eyes and the charred ears and the baked apple in the open mouth, there was no question about what it was. As she set it on the counter, she thought again about the reflection she'd seen in the foyer. But never mind that now. Her gut was a roar of famishment. She plucked a butcher's knife out of the drawer from which she had taken the meat fork and cut off the place where Mr. Rat had been eating the way you'd cut a wormhole out of an apple. She tossed this piece back over her shoulder, then picked up the roast entire and buried her face in it. From the door, Jake watched her. When the keenest edge had been taken off her hunger, Mia looked around the kitchen with an expression that wavered between calculation and despair. What was she supposed to do when the roast was gone? What was she supposed to eat the next time this sort of hunger came? And where was she supposed to find what her chap really wanted, really needed? She'd do anything to locate that stuff and secure a good supply of it, that special food or drink or vitamin or whatever it was. The pork was close enough to put him to sleep again, thank all the gods and the man Jesus, but not close enough. She banged Cy Piggy back into the roasting pan for the nonce, pulled the shirt she was wearing off over her head, and turned it so she could look at the front. There was a cartoon pig, roasted bright red but seeming not to mind. It was smiling blissfully. Above it, in rustic letters made to look like barn board, was this: "The Dixie Pig, Lex and 61st. Below it, "Best Ribs in New York, Gourmet Magazine." "The Dixie Pig," she thought. "The Dixie Pig. Where have I heard that before?" She didn't know, but she believed she could find Lex if she had to. "It'd be right there between 3rd and Park," she said. "That's right, ain't it?" The boy, who had slipped back out but left the door ajar, heard this and nodded miserably. That was where it was, all right. "Well, oh well," Mia thought, "it all does fine for now, good as it can do anyway. And like that woman in the book said, tomorrow's another day. Worry about it then. Right. Right." She picked up the roast again and began to eat. The smacking sounds she made were really not much different from those made by the rat. Really, not much different at all. 2. Tian and Zelia had tried to give Eddie and Susanna their bedroom, convincing them that their guests really didn't want their bedroom, that sleeping there would actually make them uncomfortable hadn't been easy. It was Susanna who finally turned the trick, telling the Jaffordses in a hesitant, confiding voice that something awful had happened to them in the City of Lud, something so traumatic that neither of them could sleep easily in a house anymore. A barn, where you could see the door open to the outside world any time you wanted to take a look, was much better. It was a good tale and well told. Tian and Zelia listened with a sympathetic credulity that made Eddie feel guilty. A lot of bad things had happened to them in Lud, that much was true, but nothing which made either of them nervous about sleeping indoors. At least he guessed not. Since leaving their own world, the two of them had only spent a single night, the previous, under the actual roof of an actual house. Now he sat cross-legged on one of the blankets Zelia had given them to spread on the hay, the other two cast aside. He was looking out into the yard, past the porch where Grandpere had told his tale, and toward the river. The moon flitted in and out of the clouds, first brightening the scene to silver, then darkening it. Eddie hardly saw what he was looking at. His ears were trained on the floor of the barn below him, where the stalls and pens were. She was down there somewhere. He was sure she was. But God, she was so quiet. And by the way, who is she? Mia, Roland says, but that's just a name. Who is she, really? But it wasn't just a name. It means mother in the high speech, the gunslinger had said. It means mother. Yeah. But she's not the mother of my kid. The chap is not my son. A soft clunk from below him, followed by the creak of a board. Eddie stiffened. She was down there, all right. He'd begun to have his doubts, but she was. He had awakened, after perhaps 6 hours of deep and dreamless sleep, to discover she was gone. He went to the barn's bay door, which they'd left open, and looked out. There she was. Even by moonlight, he'd known that wasn't really Susanna down there in the wheelchair. Not his Sue's, not Odetta Holmes, or Detta Walker either. Yet she wasn't entirely unfamiliar. She... You saw her in New York. Only then she had legs and she knew how to use them. She had legs and she didn't want to go too close to the rose. She had her reasons for that, and they were good reasons. But you know what I think the real reason was? I think she was afraid it would hurt whatever it is she's carrying in her belly. Yet he felt sorry for the woman below. No matter who she was or what she was carrying, she'd gotten herself into the situation while saving Jake Chambers. She'd held off the demon of the circle, trapping it inside her just long enough for Eddie to finish whittling the key he'd made. If you'd finished it earlier, if you hadn't been such a damned little chicken shit, she might not even be in this mess. Did you ever think of that? Eddie had pushed the thought away. There was some truth to it, of course. He had lost his confidence while whittling the key, which was why it hadn't been finished when the time of Jake's drawing came. But he was done with that kind of thinking. It was good for nothing but creating a truly excellent array of self-inflicted wounds. Whoever she was, his heart had gone out to the woman he saw below him. In the sleeping silence of the night, through the alternating shutters of moonlight and dark, she pushed Susanna's wheelchair first across the yard, then back, then across again, then left, then right. She reminded him a little of the old robots in Shardik's clearing, the ones Roland had made him shoot. And was that so surprising? He'd drifted off to sleep thinking of those robots, and what Roland had said of them. They are creatures of great sadness, I think, in their own way. Eddie is going to put them out of their misery. And so he had, after some persuasion. The one that looked like a many-jointed snake, the one that looked like the Tonka tractor he'd once gotten as a birthday present, the ill-tempered, stainless steel rat. He'd shot them all except for the last. Some sort of mechanical flying thing. Roland had gotten that one. Like the old robots, the woman in the yard below wanted to go someplace but didn't know where. She wanted to get something, but didn't know what. The question was, what was he supposed to do? Just watch and wait. Use the time to think up some other bullshit story in case one of them wakes up and sees her in the dooryard pacing around in her wheelchair. More post-traumatic stress syndrome from Lud, maybe. Hey, it works for me, he murmured, but just then Susanna had turned and wheeled back toward the barn, now moving with a purpose. Eddie had lain down, prepared to feign sleep, but instead of hearing her coming upstairs, he had heard a faint cling, a grunt of effort, then the creak of boards going away toward the rear of the barn. In his mind's eye, he saw her getting out of her chair and heading back there at her usual speedy crawl. For what? 5 minutes of silence. He was just beginning to get really nervous when there was a single squeal, short and sharp. It was so much like the cry of an infant that his balls pulled up tight and his skin broke out in goose flesh. He looked toward the ladder leading down to the barn floor and made himself wait some more. That was a pig. One of the young ones. Just a shoat, that's all. Maybe. But what he kept picturing was the younger set of twins, especially the girl. Leah rhymes with Mia. No more than babies, and it was crazy to think of Susanna cutting a child's throat. Totally insane, but that's not Susanna down there, and if you start thinking it is, you're apt to get hurt, the way you almost got hurt before. Hurt, hell, almost killed was what he'd been. Almost gotten his face chewed off by the lobstrosities. It was Detta who threw me to the creepy crawlies. This one isn't her. Yes, and he had an idea, only an intuition, really, that this one might be a hell of a lot nicer than Detta, but he'd be a fool to bet his life on it. Or the lives of the children? Tien and Zalia's children? He sat there sweating, not knowing what to do. Now, after what seemed an interminable wait, there were more squeaks and creaks. The last came from directly beneath the ladder leading to the loft. Eddie lay back again and closed his eyes. Not quite all the way, though. Peering through his lashes, he saw her head appear above the loft floor. At that moment, the moon sailed out from behind a cloud and flooded the loft with light. He saw blood at the corners of her mouth, as dark as chocolate, and reminded himself to wipe it off her in the morning. He didn't want any of the Jafford clan seeing it. What I want to see is the twins, Eddie thought. Both sets, all four, alive and well. Especially Leah. What else do I want? For Tien to come out of the barn with a frown on his face, for him to ask us if we heard anything in the night, maybe a fox, or even one of those rock cats they talk about, because, see, one of the shoats has gone missing. Hope you hid whatever was left of it, Mia, or whoever you are. Hope you hid it well. She came to him, lay down, turned over once, and fell asleep. He could tell by the sound of her breathing. Eddie turned his head and looked toward the sleeping Jafford's home place. She didn't go anywhere near the house.
No. Not unless she'd wheeled her chair all the way through the barn and right out the back, that was. Gone around that way, slipped in a window, taken one of the younger twins, taken the little girl, taken her back to the barn, and...
She didn't do that. Didn't have the time, for one thing. Maybe not, but he'd feel a lot better in the morning, just the same, when he saw all the kids at breakfast. Including Aaron, the little boy with the chubby legs and the little sticking-out belly. He thought of what his mother sometimes said when she saw a mother wheeling a little one like that along the street. So cute, looks good enough to eat.
Quit it, go to sleep.
But it was a long time before Eddie got back to sleep. 3. Jake awoke from his nightmare with a gasp, not sure where he was. He sat up, shivering, arms wrapped around himself. He was wearing nothing but a plain cotton shirt, too big for him, and flimsy cotton shorts, sort of like gym shorts, that were also too big for him. What? There was a grunt, followed by a muffled fart. Jake looked toward these sounds, saw Benny Slightman buried up to the eyes under two blankets, and everything fell into place. He was wearing one of Benny's undershirts and a pair of Benny's undershorts. They were in Benny's tent. They were on the bluff overlooking the river. The river banks out here were stony, Benny had said, no good for rice, but plenty good for fishing. If they were just a little bit lucky, They'd be able to catch their own breakfast out of the Divartiti Huay. And although Benny knew Jake and Oi would have to return to the old fellow's house to be with their din and their ka mates for a day or two, maybe longer, perhaps Jake could come back later on. There was good fishing here, good swimming a little way upstream, and caves where the walls glowed in the dark and the lizards glowed too. Jake had gone to sleep well satisfied by the prospect of these wonders. He wasn't crazy about being out here without a gun. He had seen too much and done too much to ever feel entirely comfortable without a gun these days. But he was pretty sure Andy was keeping an eye on them, and he'd allowed himself to sleep deep. Then the dream, the horrible dream. Susanna in the huge, dirty kitchen of an abandoned castle. Susanna holding up a squirming rat impaled on a meat fork, holding it up and laughing while blood ran down the fork's wooden handle and pulled around her hand. That was no dream, and you know it. You have to tell Roland. The thought which followed this was somehow even more disturbing. Roland already knows. So does Eddie. Jake sat with his knees against his chest and his arms linked around his shins, feeling more miserable than at any time since getting a good look at his final essay in Miss Avery's English comp class. My Understanding of the Truth, it had been called, and although he understood it a lot better now, understood how much of it must have been called forth by what Roland called the touch, his first reaction had been pure horror. What he felt now wasn't so much horror as it was, well, sadness, he thought. Yes, they were supposed to be quartet, one from many, but now their unity had been lost. Susanna had become another person, and Roland didn't want her to know, not with wolves on the way both here and in the other world. Wolves of the Kala, wolves of New York. He wanted to be angry, but there seemed no one to be angry at. Susanna had gotten pregnant helping him, after all, and if Roland and Eddie weren't telling her stuff, it was because they wanted to protect her. Yeah, right, a resentful voice spoke up. They also want to make sure she's able to help out when the wolves come riding out of Thunderclap. It'd be one less gun if she was busy having a miscarriage or a nervous breakdown or something. He knew that wasn't fair, but the dream had shaken him badly. The rat was what he kept coming back to, that rat writhing on the meat fork. Her holding it up and grinning. Don't want to forget that, grinning. He'd touched the thought in her mind at that moment, and the thought had been rat kebab. Christ, he whispered. He guessed he understood why Roland wasn't telling Susanna about Mia and about the baby, what Mia called the chap, but didn't the gunslinger understand that something far more important had been lost, and was getting more lost every day this was allowed to go on? They know better than you. They're grown-ups. Jake thought that was bullshit. If being a grown-up really meant knowing better, why did his father go on smoking 3 packs of unfiltered cigarettes a day and snorting cocaine until his nose bled? If being a grown-up gave you some sort of special knowledge of the right things to do, how come his mother was sleeping with her masseuse, who had huge biceps and no brains? Why had neither of them noticed, as the spring of 1977 marched toward summer, that their kid, who had a nickname, Bama, known only to the housekeeper, was losing his fucking mind? This isn't the same thing. But what if it was? What if Roland and Eddie were so close to the problem they couldn't see the truth? What is the truth? What is your understanding of the truth? That they were no longer quartet. That was his understanding of the truth. What was it Roland had said to Callahan at that first palaver? We are round and roll as we do. That had been true then, but Jake didn't think it was true now. He remembered an old joke people told when they got a blowout. Well, it's only flat on the bottom. That was them now, flat on the bottom. No longer truly quartet, how could they be when they were keeping secrets? And was Mia and the child growing in Susanna's stomach the only secret? Jake thought not. There was something else as well, something Roland was keeping back, not just from Susanna, but from all of them. We can beat the wolves if we're together, he thought. If we're quartet, but not the way we are now.
Not over here, not in New York either. I just don't believe it.
Another thought came on the heels of that, one so terrible he first tried to push it away. Only he couldn't do that, he realized. Little as he wanted to, this was an idea that had to be considered.
I could take matters into my own hands. I could tell her myself.
And then what? What would he tell Roland? How would he explain?
I couldn't. There'd be no explanation I could make or that he'd listen to. The only thing I could do...
He remembered Roland's story of the day he'd stood against court. The battered old squireen with his stick, the untried boy with his hawk. If he, Jake, were to go against Roland's decision and tell Susanna what had so far been held back from her, it would lead directly to his own manhood test.
And I'm not ready. Maybe Roland was, barely, but I'm not him. Nobody is. He'd best me, and I'd be sent east into Thunderclap alone. Oi would try to come with me, but I couldn't let him, because it's death over there. Maybe for our whole quartet, surely for a kid all by himself.
And yet still the secrets Roland was keeping, that was wrong. And so, they'd be together again, all of them, to hear the rest of Callahan's story, and maybe to deal with the thing in Callahan's church. What should he do then?
Talk to him. Try to persuade him he's doing the wrong thing.
All right, he could do that. It would be hard, but he could do it. Should he talk to Eddie as well? Jake thought not. Adding Eddie would complicate things even more. Let Roland decide what to tell Eddie. Roland, after all, was the dean. The flap of the tent shivered, and Jake's hand went to his side, where the Ruger would have hung if he had been wearing the Docker's clutch. Not there, of course, but this time that was all right. It was only Oi poking his snout under the flap and tossing it up so he could get his head into the tent. Jake reached out to pat the bumbler's head. Oi seized his hand gently in his teeth and tugged. Jake went with him willingly enough. He felt as if sleep were 1,000 miles away. Outside the tent, the world was a study in severe blacks and whites. A rock-studded slope led down to the river, which was broad and shallow at this point. The moon burned in it like a lamp. Jake saw two figures down there on the rocky strand and froze. As he did, the moon went behind a cloud and the world darkened. Oi's jaws closed on his hand again and pulled him forward. Jake went with him, found a 4-foot drop, and eased himself down. Oi now stood above and just behind him, panting into his ear like a little engine. The moon came out from behind its cloud. The world brightened again. Jake saw Oi had led him to a large chunk of granite that came jutting out of the earth like the prow of a buried ship. It was a good hiding place. He peered around it and down at the river. There was no doubt about one of them. Its height and the moonlight gleaming on metal were enough to identify Andy, the messenger robot, many other functions. The other one, though, who was the other one? Jake squinted, but at first couldn't tell. It was at least 200 yards from his hiding place to the riverbank below, and although the moonlight was brilliant, it was also tricky. The man's face was raised so he could look at Andy, and the moonlight fell squarely on him, but the features seemed to swim. Only the hat the guy was wearing. He knew the hat. You could be wrong. Then the man turned his head slightly. The moonlight sent twin glints back from his face, and Jake knew for sure. There might be lots of cowpokes in the collar who wore round-crowned hats like the one yonder, but Jake had only seen a single guy so far who wore spectacles. Okay, it's Benny's dad. What of it? Not all parents are like mine. Some of them get worried about their kids, especially if they've already lost one the way Mr. Sleitman lost Benny's twin sister. To hot lung, Benny said, which probably means pneumonia. 6 years ago. So we come out here camping, and Mr. Sleitman sends Andy to keep an eye on us, only then he wakes up in the middle of the night and decides to check on us for himself. Maybe he had his own bad dream. Maybe so. But that didn't explain why Andy and Mr. Sleitman were having their palaver way down there by the river, did it? Well, maybe he was afraid of waking us up. Maybe he'll come up to check on the tent now, in which case I better get back inside it. Or maybe he'll take Andy's word that we're all right and head back to the Rocking Bee. The moon went behind another cloud, and Jake thought it best to stay where he was until it came back out. When it did, what he saw filled him with the same sort of dismay he'd felt in his dream following Mia through that deserted castle. For a moment, he clutched at the possibility that this was a dream, that he'd simply gone from one to another. But the feel of the pebbles biting into his feet and the sound of Oi panting in his ear were completely undreamlike. This was happening, all right. Mr. Sleitman wasn't coming up toward where the boys had pitched their tent, and he wasn't heading back toward the Rocking Bee either, although Andy was, in long strides along the bank. No, Benny's father was wading across the river. He was heading dead east. He could have a reason for going over there. He could have a perfectly good reason. Really? What might that perfectly good reason be? It wasn't the Kala anymore over there, Jake knew that much. Over there was nothing but waste ground and desert, a buffer between the borderlands and the kingdom of the dead that was Thunderclap. First something wrong with Susanna, his friend Susanna, now it seemed something wrong with the father of his new friend. Jake realized he had begun to gnaw at his nails, a habit he'd picked up in his final weeks at Piper School, and made himself stop. "This isn't fair, you know," he said to Oi. "This isn't fair at all." Oi licked his ear. Jake turned, put his arms around the bumbler, and pressed his face against his friend's lush coat. The bumbler stood patiently, allowing this. After a little while, Jake pulled himself back up to the more level ground where Oi stood. He felt a little better, a little comforted. The moon went behind another cloud, and the world darkened. Jake stood where he was. Oi whined softly. "Just a minute," Jake murmured. The moon came out again. Jake looked hard at the place where Andy and Ben Sleitman had palavered, marking it in his memory. There was a large round rock with a shiny surface. A dead log had washed up against it. Jake was pretty sure he could find the spot again, even if Benny's tent was gone. "Are you going to tell Roland?" "I don't know," he muttered.
"No,"
Oi said from beside his ankle, making Jake jump a little. Or was it N-O? Was that what the bumbler had actually said? "Are you crazy?" He wasn't. There was a time when he'd thought he was crazy, crazy or going there in one hell of a hurry, but he didn't think that anymore. And sometimes Oi did read his mind, he knew it. Jake slipped back into the tent. Then he was still fast asleep. Jake looked at the other boy, older in years but younger in a lot of the ways that mattered, for several seconds, biting his lip. He didn't want to get Benny's father in trouble, not unless he had to. Jake lay down and pulled his blankets up to his chin. He had never in his life felt so undecided about so many things. And he wanted to cry. The day had begun to grow light before he was able to get back to sleep.